Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and break it down as far as it can possibly go. My name is Sam Dunnewald, my pronouns are he, him, and my co-host today is Ray Chow. Ray is best known as the co-founder of MythWorks, a comics and games publisher, formerly Mythopia, which they rebranded because, as Ray explained to me, no one can say Mythopia. It's the publishing company behind The Wild Sea and Cyberpunk, and soon the second printing of Slug Blaster, real power trio of Forge in the Dark adjacent games. But I knew Ray first as just a guy at a Los Angeles indie games meetup, and from hanging around on the Blades in the Dark Discord. And he's a designer, not just a publisher. He's got this lovely one-shot time travel romp of a game called Time Force that he co-designed with his MythWorks partner, Vincenzo Ferriero. I've always loved talking and playing with Ray. And on this episode, Ray brings us Rolling the Dice, the core mechanic from John Harper's Lasers and Feelings, a game that's pretty self-evidently a Star Trek pastiche. It's also probably the most iconic one-page RPG out there, besides maybe Honey Heist, which we also get into. This is a conversation that goes, deep. We start by breaking down the elegance of this mechanic's simplicity, but we end up talking about genre and fate and free will and whether you need mechanics to play RPGs at all. And that's why I wanted to start this whole Dice Exploder project with this episode, because just how far afield we get here is exactly what I want this show to be about. How a pretty simple mechanic can echo out in ridiculously wide ways. So let's get into it. Here is Ray Chow with Rolling the Dice. Ray Chow. Hey.
Hey, everyone.
What have you got for us today?
Today, I am bringing in the core resolution mechanics from John Harper's Lasers and Feelings, his famous one-page hack. And it reads as follows. Rolling the dice. When you do something risky, roll 1d6 to find out how it goes. Roll plus one dice if you're prepared and plus one dice if you're an expert. The GM tells you how many dice to roll based on your character and the situation. Roll your dice and compare each die result to your number.
Do we want to pause here and talk about your number in this game?
Absolutely.
Because in the character creation for Lasers and Feelings, basically your entire character creation process is you pick a number between 2 and 5. Can you do 1 and 6? That feels like it'd be excessive. And that's your character's number.
So the important thing to note is that Well, we'll get back to the text and hopefully it'll make sense. Do you want to read the second part of the text, Sam?
Yeah, great. All right, so you've got all these dice in your hand. If you're using lasers, science and reason, whatever, you want to roll under your number. If you're using feelings, rapport, passion, you want to roll over your number. So just to clarify, your number is, if you have a low number, then you're good at feeling stuff. And if you have a high number, then you're good at laser stuff. And whichever one you're not good at, you are good at the other one. So either you're a feelings person or you're a lasers person. And like, as you become better at lasers, you become worse at feelings.
Right. And that's really the core mechanic that I wanted to explore. Basically, Lasers and Feelings is, for those who are unfamiliar, it's a Star Trek hack with the serial numbers filed off. It primarily models the original series Star Trek, the 70s version with Captain Kirk, that type of idea. So Lasers and Feelings, but the core resolution mechanic has two stats, Lasers and Feelings, and they are opposite of each other. So if you're good at one, you're bad at the other. And that's determined by that number we were mentioning earlier.
Yeah. All right. So you want to take up the next section, the actual results?
Sure. If none of your dice succeed, it goes wrong. The GM says how things get worse somehow. If one die succeeds, you barely manage it. The GM inflicts a complication, harm, or cost. If two die succeed, you do it well. Good job. If three die succeed, you get a critical success. The GM tells you some extra effect you get. If you roll your number exactly, you have laser feelings. You get a special insight. Pew, pew, pew. What's going on? You get to ask the GM a question and they'll answer you honestly. Some good questions include, what are they feeling? Who's behind this? How could I get to them? What should I be on the lookout for? What's the best way to blank? And what's really going on here? So that's kind of a riff off of a PBTA type of mechanic where it kind of defines the questions that you should ask, which is pretty cool.
And then, of course, a roll of laser feelings counts as a success. And that is the entire mechanic. So you got into this a little bit, but like, talk about why you wanted to bring this in.
Yeah, I think that Lasers and Feelings is a game that every aspiring RPG designer should play as well as hack at least once. And I think that a core part of that is the resolution mechanic. My main thing with Lasers and Feelings is that it distills the essence of what an RPG does so beautifully, minimalistically, elegantly, and I'm just saying synonyms now, but it's an awesome, awesome system that teaches you so much about what an RPG is and what it can be and what you need versus what you don't need, which I think is a very, very important lesson for everyone playing RPGs and designing RPGs.
Yeah, we're going to come back on this show a lot of times, I think, to how much I friggin' love minimalism. And like, this is just an absolute triumph of it. Like, you pack in... So, like, the idea of a character having a single number that is, you know, it's a sliding scale is what it is. It's like, where are you on the spectrum from black to white or from lasers to feelings or, like, whatever your game is about? First of all, it, like, defines so much about your character, where you put yourself on that slider, and it defines the entire genre of the game in a single slider. Like, it's so efficient. It does so much, and then... All you're doing is a single number. Like, it's just all in a single character. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, so many thoughts from this. Number one, like, the idea of minimalism is a very interesting one, I think, with RPGs specifically, because I've observed that as designers tend to get deeper down the rabbit hole, they begin to value minimalism a little bit more. Like, they kind of become, they mm-hmm. like minimalistic games. They see the beauty and elegance of minimalistic games. And a lot of people aspiring to design RPGs when they first start off, especially Forge in the Dark designers, certainly ones that hack D20 systems, they have the idea of the Fantasy Heartbreaker, right? Where they want to design this perfectly massive tome of a game that is going to be their masterpiece right off the bat. But it's really hard to design a large game, complicated game that is also elegant and wonderful and fits together really well. And I think that starting from the opposite end, from a smaller game, helps designers understand what's important about a game and what's not. And yeah, I think M made this comment in one of the threads in the Forge in the Dark channel recently, where the more experience you get, the more you tend to, as a designer, want to go towards minimalism. But that's kind of a double-edged sword too, because minimalistic games aren't necessarily the most popular games. I wish they were more popular, but
yeah.
People tend to latch onto more mechanics and think that more mechanics means more game, when sometimes the opposite is true in a weird way.
Yeah.
So yeah, that idea of like a minimalism in design, especially RPG designs, is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit of a movement right now. Like, just the vibes I've been getting around my corner of the design scene is people are kind of tired of long, big ass friggin' games and like are more thinking about how can they play smaller stuff. Like, I've seen a lot of people really latch onto the like 6-session campaign lately, and I hope we get to see more of that, and I hope that brings us more games on the order of like Lasers and Feelings with bells and whistles, as opposed to like full-on Force in the Dark hacks. Another thing that you kind of covered here that I think is really compelling about Lasers and Feelings from a designer perspective is you really do see so many different knobs on this move of what can you change to make a different statement about your game, right? You can change Lasers and Feelings, like the labels, and like by the end of this, I'm sure we will be sharing our favorite Lasers and Feelings hacks, right?
Yeah.
But you can also just change, like, how do you get dice? Like, If you're prepared and you're an expert right now, you get bonus dice, right? But like, if you're making a game that doesn't care whether you're prepared or if you're an expert, if you want to make a game that's about like family drama, so maybe you like get plus one die if you are trying to screw over a family member because the whole game is about that. Like, that's just such an easy change, and it like makes the whole game about that thing now, in the same way that changing lasers to whatever the heck else you're going to change lasers to. I don't know why I can't think of it, one of the thousand of lasers and feelings hacks off the top of my head right now, but like just changing those words, it changes that genre in the same way.
Right. I think of it as like, if you were to picture the mechanic of lasers and feelings, it's kind of like an elegant, I don't know, seesaw system, right? Where it, depending on what you put on one side, the other side kind of raises or lowers. And that's generally the two words, right? The poetic layer, the lasers and feelings. The best hacks, I think, have some sort of relationship between those ideas, lasers representing science, feelings representing emotions, kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. You alluded it to earlier, like black and white, or, you know, perhaps like individualism versus duty, something like that.
Yeah, but just to give my favorite one of these hacks is Cows and Boys, which first of all is a hilarious joke of a title, but second of all, like, you just immediately know you're playing Brokeback Mountain, and you know that cow's stuff is the same as lasers. It's doing cowboy shit, and boy's stuff is feelings. It's like interacting with the boys. It's talking to people. It's having crushes. And like the best of these games, I think, do exactly what you're saying of like having a relationship between the two stats and having that relationship be so clear that the two stats are the name of the game, and that tells you everything you need to know about the game.
Yep. That certainly is my experience as well with these type of hacks. And to your point earlier, how you add on the different weights to the seesaw, that's almost like your dice pool, right? So in this case, it's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, you know, if you get one base, and if you have an advantage or a great advantage, then boom, you get extra dice to it for a maximum of three. But you can certainly tweak that into more thematic elements, like in your family betrayal game as an example. So how to build a dice pool, that's something you could certainly tweak, and certainly the actual big poetic names of what the two big stats are will definitely affect what type of game you're playing.
That kind of seesawing also brings us to what I think of as the game's only obvious problem, which was, how do you differentiate characters that have the same number? When you're sitting down at a table to play, if you're playing a GM and four people, then everyone can have a different number. You know, you have 2, 3, 4, and 5. Those are the four numbers that you can have. Maybe everyone has a different one. But like, how do you differentiate the person who picked 4 from the person who picked 5? And there's ways to do it, obviously, right? And in some ways, the game is nice because it sort of invites you to think about that distinction. But also, it's not giving you a lot of handholds for like where to take that. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's not. It's just something I always notice when I do sit down with a lasers and feelings hack.
Yeah, I think that strikes to a thing in RPGs as a whole where you don't necessarily want characters that are too similar. If you're playing D&D, you don't want two bard-like characters who just want to talk through it, because it'll be hard to share the spotlight with them. You don't want sometimes in Blades, you don't want to necessarily take the same action points, right? Because you don't want to, like, you know, step on another person's toes. And even with the minimum system like lasers and feelings, what I would suggest is the character creation, right? Where you choose a different style, alien, android, dangerous, heroic, etc., and choose a role for your character. Those two things, you would probably need to scaffold a lot onto those two aspects to try and differentiate the characters.
Yeah. And I don't even know that it's always like a problem straight up. Like, it can be fun to play the D&D game where everyone's a bard, because like that brings a certain character to the game. Mm-hmm. Or if you're playing lasers and feelings and you're all just like, we're lasers people, then suddenly your campaign like takes on this, it becomes about how you're all bad at interacting with people, and maybe we're going to lean into that. But I think you have to do that intentionally. Like, the default feels like what you are saying. We want some differentiation. We want to make sure it's obvious how every character is going to shine in their own way, and we're not going to just have a gaggle of people that are roughly indistinguishable from each other, because that's not what stories are about.
Yeah, definitely agree.
The other thing that I immediately noted when I was rereading this game, preparing for this episode, I'd forgotten that you actually roll more than one die. I just did a hack of this, actually, where you just have a number and you only roll one die ever. And realizing that you roll more than one dice, it it made me realize how good characters are at just doing stuff in this game. Like, even if you are trying to roll, you know, over five, if that's your number, like, if you get two or three dice and, like, that's not hard to do when you start with one and you can be prepared. And this isn't included in rolling in the dice, but you can get another die if someone helps you. Three dice trying to roll a five or higher, like, you're more than 50% to do that. And that's if you're... if your number is the worst possible number for the job. I think it makes a lot of sense that, like, characters are good at stuff in this particular genre, and especially, you know, I'd also forgotten the part where one die is a partial success, basically. And so, you know, you're doing that classic PBTA kind of thing of, like, constantly hitting that partial success by rolling one success. But still, like, characters are competent in this game.
Right, and I think that's a very important thing to think about when you're designing games, certainly Forged in the Dark games. There's always a lot of discussion in the hack channels about, you know, what the action roles are and what you can rename them to. But I think from a meta perspective, it's the idea of, okay, well, do you want your players to be rolling mostly 2 to 3 dice, 3 to 4 dice, or, you know, 4 to 5 dice, or 5 to 6 dice? Because each one of those zones has a very, very different feeling in terms of how competent your player, yeah, your characters are. And certainly Lasers and Feelings, it's not exactly a 1-to-1 match, because it's a slightly different resolution, yeah, mechanic, where it's a, you know, multiple successes rather than you do it with a complication on a 4 or 5. But it is important to think about what the genre, what the tone of your game is, and find a dice pool system and a resolution system that kind of matches. And, you know, I'm not a very mathematically oriented person, so for me it's more of like a like a mouthfeel or a roll feel kind of feeling, right? Like, all right, that's, yeah, yeah. So I kind of just simplify or abstract it into like 1, 2 dice, 3, 4, 5, 6, so on and so forth. But I'm sure if you look at the numbers, you know, you can map it out into like a curve or whatever the case may be and see that as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happens when a chosen one decides he'd rather make pastries than fulfill prophecies? He opens a bakery. Absolutely No Adventures is an audio drama that follows Chosen One Sig as he dodges quests alongside his eldritch horror baking assistant and isekai'd New Yorker witch friend. In each bite-sized episode, he has a new epic adventure to avoid at all costs, while making friends and a few enemies along the way. Check us out on your favorite podcasting apps for breads, pies, cookies, cakes, and absolutely no adventures.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the lineage of this game, because I think when I discussed this with you, Sam, very briefly on the Discord, I mentioned Lasers and Feelings, and I also mentioned Honey Heist, and you kind of brought up, you're like, oh, I didn't know Honey Heist was a hack of it, so I actually kind of looked into it, and what I found was that Lasers and Feelings and Honey Heist descend from the same lineage of game, which is 316 Carnage Amongst the Stars by the UK designer Gregor Hutton, and that was released in 2008, I believe. So in that game, all skills were defined as fighting action or non-fighting action. And the game, I've never played it, but from what I've read, it's basically a Space Marines versus Bug Aliens game. But it is certainly one that was influential in that both John Harper mentions it in a couple of his interviews as a big influence, and Grant Howitt attributes it directly as well. So as far as I know, and in my amateur RPG historian knowledge, that was the first time where this kind of bicameral resolution mechanic, I like to call it bicameral because it sounds cool, but basically like the two-stat pool system.
Got to make it sound like you went to a liberal arts college, you know?
That's right. That's right. Now, I watched Westworld one time and, you know, the bicameral man, stole it from there.
Yeah. I think it is interesting. So Honey Heist is a game in which you are trying to steal honey from HoneyCon 2016 or whenever the game came out. And also you're a goddamn bear is part of the text of the game. And your stats in that game are bear and criminal, which... clearly, this is a very iconic and famous game. I think Bear and Criminal do a good job of inventing a genre of their very own in two stats. But that game, you don't have a single number in the same way. Like, your criminal and your bear stats are distinct from each other. And often you are told to subtract one from bear and add it to criminal under certain circumstances, or the other way around. And so they kind of have this push-pull in the same way, but they are technically different numbers. And I think that it still feels like a very minimal mechanic, but it also feels really different to not have them sort of both entwined in that same number at the core of your character in the way that Lasers and Feelings does.
Yeah, definitely. And in that system, Honey Heist, when you reach six in one stat, you have a endgame scenario where you're taken off the board, basically. So you become fully feral as a bear, or you betray one of your allies as a criminal, which kind of alludes to Rowan, Rook, and Decker, the other stuff that they do in their systems, where they very much have like endgame scenarios built into to their character progression.
We'll have to get someone to bring on the mechanic in Heart, where you just like bring a train through the scene to like run over one of your enemies, and then you like get on the train and go away, or whatever. I can't remember how it works, but they certainly have some big endgame moves. Honey Heist is also a nice demonstration with just little things like that and the idea of changing your number of kind of other places you can go with a mechanic this small. Even though this feels so minimal, again, there's just a lot of knobs on it, a surprising number of knobs on it that you can turn one way or another or add to, especially when your game is so small to begin with, right? Like, of course, each knob makes a huge difference.
So in thinking about this, I was kind of thinking of other like craft forms and what the equivalent would be. I thought about like sculpting, right? Sculptures, and how you can have like one single elegant Mobius strip sculpture, right? Versus like making something that's like a huge samurai suit with a million different parts. And that kind of is like a good analogy for complicated RPGs versus simple ones. Simple one, it's like there's one shape, all of the things kind of intertwine together and they all interact with each other in interesting ways. Whereas a complicated one, that may be the case, but each individual piece is a little bit separate. Or in cooking is the other example that I was thinking of. If you're making like a very delicious, simple, elegant Italian dish with only five ingredients, everything is going to matter. Like how well prepared every ingredient is, how fresh every ingredient is going to be noticed in the dish as a whole. And that's certainly one way to do it. And another way is by making a dish with 40 components, and each one, you know, has its own thing.
You making that Guy Fieri trash can nachos version of the game instead, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But when you have just five ingredients, when you just have a couple of mechanics like Lasers and Feelings does, besides the core resolution mechanic, there's basically just a bunch of D6 tables. And man, I want to come back on the show and talk about those tables too sometime. But that's pretty much the entire game, right? And everything has to work. Every bit is important in a small game because you have so much less to work with. So all of it has to fit together really, really well.
Yeah, there's something really interesting. Like, I've heard of people running Lasers and Feelings campaigns, too. Like, this is not something I've done myself, but like I can imagine doing with a similarly sized game of you just don't need that much infrastructure to run a long-term campaign. I know people really like advancement and like complication. You know, there's something satisfying about, you know, the experience of playing Blades in the Dark and gaining system mastery, sort of like understanding how to use all of the tools in that game to help tell your story. But like fundamentally, all you need to tell a good story is like good characters and like in an RPG setting, like a way to inject some randomness, or not even that, in a game, just some way to help structure your story, move forward. And Lasers and Feelings, like this core resolution mechanic, just has it all. It has like a way to define your character in the number. It has a way to resolve risky situations and move the fiction forward in that way. And like elsewhere in the game, it has, like you were saying, just like a few little tables that can like set you off on adventures. And that's just all you need for a game.
Yeah. And this is a bit of a tangent, but what I found for longer term campaigns is what kind of matters, at least in the games I run, is I have a tendency to jump the shark when it comes to like a campaign or a game, in the sense that once you've achieved really large beats, if the genre doesn't support more than that happening a couple of times, then you're kind of running out of track, right?
Yeah, totally.
So for Lasers and Feelings, it's good because it already has this kind of campy campaign where you're going against space aliens and cosmic beings. So you can theoretically keep on doing that, right?
And yeah, I mean, it's based on network television, right? That episodic, like, what's the cool space adventure of the week kind of thing. And, like, got what, 50 seasons of Star Trek, 100 seasons of Star Trek off of just, like, what's the weird space thing that happens next week? Of course you can go forever.
Right, so that's a genre that supports it. The rules are the rules, right? And sometimes they have rules where, you know, they support campaign play or progression, but that's really just sort of a track type of thing to make sure that you're not jumping the shark too much, right? Like for Blades in the Dark, if you go and try and kill the Emperor at your first mission, you're probably going to die because the mechanics enforce that. But if you were to do that, you probably don't have much place to go in the rest of the campaign if your GM allows for that.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where campaigns run out of steam, is that they don't necessarily have the push pull of like the story beats, because you got to like fail a little bit to succeed, right? And kind of that idea. But anyway, that's totally neither here nor there.
Yeah. I want to come back to another sort of detail of this mechanic, and that's the very first sentence fragment of when you do something risky. Because I think in a lot of, especially small games, like these minimalistic games where, you know, you only have one page or you're trying to keep it short, so you don't have a ton of space to extrapolate on, like, when you should pick up the dice. You're not going to write that advice in your book. Or maybe you're just new to the RPG scene at large and don't quite have that instinct worked out yet of like when you should roll dice or when the GM should call for dice to be rolled. And I think when you do something risky is a fine sort of trigger. It's certainly very efficient for describing when you should roll dice. But I have found that like it's not actually good enough for me. Like sometimes you want the risky thing to just succeed, and sometimes you want the risky thing to just fail, and sometimes you want to roll even when it's not risky because there is something else going on here that like failure would be interesting even if it's not risky. And I just think that like when you do something risky is a little bit vague enough that it sort of lets the playgroup decide when to roll dice, and then it's kind of relying on this like culture of play and like oral tradition almost within the RPG scene of like when you pick up the dice in a way that like works, but like I wish there was something better there. Like I just wish I could describe intuitively in my own heart of hearts to someone else when they're supposed to friggin' pick up the dice.
Totally. It's such a tricky thing, and I think there is no one consensus as to when you are or you aren't supposed to. My short, kind of vague, non-helpful answer is, well, it depends.
Yeah.
Basically, it depends, right? Sometimes I like to roll when the stakes aren't so high, or maybe the game just needs it, right? Maybe things are stalling a little bit, or it's like, well, let's inject some randomness into the situation to see what happens from here. And I think a lot of it depends on the genre that you're playing, right? Like the table culture that you mentioned. For Lasers and Feelings, for instance, it's leans towards a more goofy game, so I would expect there to be some goofy roles for players, right? They want to do some goofy things and they want to see if that happens or not. And I think a lot of it also depends on what the consequences of said game could be. Now, for Lasers and Feelings, there's not a lot of guidance on that aspect of it. But for a game like Blades in the Dark, there are a lot of aspects where there's a whole big GM guide, but there's also mechanics like resistance.
Yeah.
Which completely change how hard the GM can punch. And in that game, explicitly, you're supposed to try and kill your players, right? Or you're supposed to kill your players every once in a while, like if they do things, and you're supposed to let them resist that as a means of tugging on those mechanics. So it is a really tricky thing. And I don't know if there's one universal guide that can be written by saying like, okay, this is when you roll dice versus this is when you don't. Because I think it will depend a lot on the table that you're playing with and what they want to do, right? Like,
yeah.
It's based off of what you find interesting. Like, if my player wants to arm wrestle the big guy, burly guy in the brawl and see if he wins that, right? And like, it's not really up to me as a GM. Like, I can't really decide, well, that's not interesting, and just say you succeed, because the player, by asking if they can roll, is indicating that they would find that interesting. So there's kind of like a give and take going on at the table as well.
Yeah. I think sometimes when you pick up the dice, you like go back and you're just rolling for something trivial that doesn't matter, right? You're rolling for like, can I walk down the stairs after I got up in the morning? And like, that's not particularly interesting. And I think an easy trap for new players to fall into. You know, no one's going to roll for like walking down the stairs. I think most people understand that's not the thing. But like, stuff that just doesn't really matter to the story, like, you can get bogged down in. But also, I think on the flip side of that, sometimes you end up in these moments where, like, you know you should be rolling, but you don't know what the stakes should be. Like, I know the stakes aren't actually that interesting if, like, the bad guy wins in this situation. No one wants the bad guy to win. Like, I'm definitely going to defeat the bad guy. So, like, what happens on a failure? And I think that there are a lot of interesting tricks for that kind of role. Like, you can do, like, oh, the thing that's at stake is, like, what does it cost me? Like, you know, am I going to go down with the bad guy? Or is the bad guy going to, like, take down my friend with him? Or, like, whatever the deal is. Or is, like, the thing that's at stake here not, like, the actual fight that we're having that he's definitely going to lose? But it's, like, can he, like, get the little information out of me that was his real plan the whole time? And like, that's the actual thing that we're rolling about. And there's moments like those that are really hard to sort of pull out of the ether and like identify that that's really the interesting stakes here. That, again, like you were saying, there's no concise way to like teach people that kind of thing, I think, especially when it's hard to identify those moments in the heat of play. But I long for a way to convey all of that in when you do something risky and you just can't. And that's always disappointing to me in basically every resolution system.
Yeah, so many thoughts here. I mean, part of it, I think, is that for people who are so into RPGs, where we think about them and we write them, and like it's a major part of our lives in terms of how much time we spend, like a big hobby, I've always thought that we kind of are chasing the dragon a little bit, right? Like, yeah, we're always looking for that perfect game, like that experience at like that just blows all other RPGs away, whether it's that the perfect system or the perfect one shot, the perfect table. And it's just such a fleeting thing, right? And like, yeah, you know, play a bunch of games and like, you know, they're great and you have a good time, but like maybe one in every 10 games is like, oh man, that just hits the spot, right? And I think we're always trying to look for that. And I feel like when you describe the consequence aspect of it, it kind of touches upon that. And I think one way of looking at the resolution mechanic or when to roll is thinking, when do I want to disclaim fate? When do I want the gods, the universe, yeah, the dice to decide? Because there are a lot of games that have no resolution mechanic, no element of chance. But I think chance is fundamentally kind of interesting because our lives are based off of chance, right? We don't know what's going to happen today or tomorrow, but we know kind of fundamentally, scientifically, that maybe time is just a different dimension, right? And maybe if you were like a higher level being or whatever the case may be, like we would see our lives written out as like a different dimension.
Yeah,
as
we're the arrival aliens. Experience. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So that gives us the idea of free will and that interplay of like free will and fate. I like think about a lot when playing RPGs, because it's like, yeah, you can do things and you can always just make it up. And if you make it up, it's almost like you're leading into the fate aspect of it, right? Like where the DM's like, well, I can just decide what happens, or yeah, I can just say what happens, but that's not fun. That's not interesting. Sometimes you want to roll some dice and see, yeah, what kind of shenanigans you can get into, right? And it's almost like that idea of giving up the free will by saying, I'm going to let chance decide. That is the idea of free will in like a apotheosis kind of like strange way, right?
Well, it makes you feel like you have some control over fate when you get to decide when fate comes in.
Right, right.
The other piece of it, I think on the flip side, is calling for a dice roll and deciding, oh, this is risky, like now it's time to roll dice, is a really easy way to sort of keep the story going when everyone's out of ideas.
Yes, yes, so much yes, right? Like when you're going in and you're jazzing a little bit and you're, you know, 30, 40 minutes in and you're like, you know, shooting the shit at the tavern or whatever. And it's like, well, I mean, like, let's roll some dice at a certain point. Right?
Someone throws a beer mug at your head. I don't freaking know. Dude, roll the dodge. Let's fucking do this.
Right. Exactly. Like that certainly is a huge aspect of it. Cause like, especially with these fiction first type of systems, that's what it's for, right? Like the resolution mechanic isn't to determine whether you lose health points or whatever the case may be, or succeed or fail. It's really to help push the story forward, right? So you're kind of just deferring to it to be like, hey, prompt me with something, because you do it with the consequence at the end of the day is just a story prompt, right? It's a, how do I move this forward?
Yeah. I want to go back to something you were saying also in there about like how we as hardcore tabletop people, like if you're hardcore enough to be listening to this podcast right now, like God bless you, you know, we're chasing the dragon of that like perfect moment and that perfect resolution system. The perfect way to convey that long screed I had in there about trying to communicate to people when they should roll dice. And like, also, if you're just like four people sitting down, none of you have ever played RPGs before for game night, and you like pull this out, probably you'll like kick it around and be like, that was weird, but we had some fun. And there was that fun moment where I rolled some dice to see if I fell down the stairs. And then I fell down the stairs and the aliens were right there. And like, that's how the game went. And there's nothing wrong with that either. That's, I think we overthink it. I just wanted to call out that part of the thing you were highlighting.
Oh, 100%. I mean, like, I think playing with RPG designers and people who are enthusiasts, it's such a different experience from your home group.
Yeah.
And when you're with your home group, they're your longtime friends. You have this rapport built up from a bunch of hours spent together playing this game or just outside. And there's this comfort level that you can get, right? So that's why when I got into designing RPGs, it was really weird because my friends decided they wanted to play D&D, right? And they asked me to run D&D, and me being, you know, snobby indie gamer, I was like, all right, like, fine. But it was the best time ever, right? It was like such a beer and pretzels game, and it was just hilarious and fun. And that always struck me as like, wow, like, you know, I'm so into the theory crafting of all of this stuff, but do the rules even matter? Right? Like, does any of what I'm talking about or thinking about really matter? And it's like, sort of, in the sense that the rules are trying to capture this imperfect experience that you're replicating and blah, 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 blah. But it matters a lot, but it also matters a lot less than we sometimes overthink it to be.
That brings us back to how much I like minimalism. You just don't need more rules than this in that kind of situation, because the framework of the game that you're playing is really 10 years of hanging out and shooting the shit. And if you have a game that is as simple as Lasers and Feelings, the game is going to stay out of the way of that dynamic that you already really like and you're already really getting a lot out of. It's going to do just enough to allow you to bring that dynamic into the fictional world of Star Trek or Brokeback Mountain or like whatever the heck game you're playing tonight, but still give you the joy of just hanging out with your friends.
Yeah, that tracks with my experience too. I've had some of the most fun I've ever had playing Lasers and Feelings and Honey Heist, where the entire group is just hurting because they're laughing so much. And that's the type of game that these little minimalist games can foster, you know, given the genre and whatever they're trying to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, you got anything else for us?
Just that I'm so happy that you're starting this series, Sam. I'm honored to be the pilot, the pilot guest here.
Thanks, Ray.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Thanks so much to Ray for joining me. I mentioned in there that I've got my own Lasers and Feelings hack, a Blade Runner-inspired game called Couriers that I think plays with everything we talked about in some pretty interesting ways. And I've got a director's commentary blog post for Couriers up at diceexploder.substack.com that you can check out if you're interested. You can find everything Ray does at www.myth.works, short and sweet site name. Cyberpunk Augmented is being fulfilled now, and the second printing of Slug Blaster is coming this fall. Keep an eye out. As for myself, as always, you can find me at sdunnewald on Twitter, dice.camp, Mastodon, and itch.io. Our thumbnail was designed by Sporgory. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And Dice Exploder is a production of the Fiction First Network, an actual play and podcast production co-op based out of the Blades in the Dark Discord. Come on by and join us. We'd love to see you there. And thanks as always to you for listening. See you next time.